Okay, thank you, Chair, and thanks to everyone for tuning in. I hope everyone can hear me okay, and I hope you all can understand my terrible Belfast Shankill Road accent. It used to be quite common to hear Belfast accent, of course, in the good old days when the main export from here used to be international terrorism. Fortunately, the bottom's kind of fallen out of that market. These days, the main exports seem to be Christian apologists and golfers. I'm not entirely sure what's preferable to listen to be honest. Rory McIlroy wittering on about golf, or as I call it, a good walk sport, or Gerry Adams wittering on about Ireland's 800 years of struggle against the English. Anyway, actually, I was advised not to attempt any jokes without everyone muted. Obviously, they just get mad with a stony silence, which is nothing new for me. Actually, come to think of it, rabbiting on about atheism and having your jokes be met with a stony silence, it never stopped Ricky Gervais. That's a description of his career. Anyway, I hope we have a good discussion later on, and I'm looking forward to hearing everyone's views. Actually, I think this topic of atheism is reasonably important. I was thinking about this today when I was thinking about speaking, and I think to myself, like, why is this topic of atheism still feel so like really important to me? And I was thinking about, in the past, the party has had, I know we've got a reputation in some quarters of being a dogmatic Marxist sect, but in actual fact, the party's had numerous discussions over the years. And I was thinking to myself, I can see myself easily being on the other side of a load of those questions, and all those questions, actually, on the other side of the argument from other comrades. It wouldn't bother me in the least. But I must say that this question of religion is absolutely where I would draw the line. I just couldn't imagine being in an organization that had people who had held religious ideas. So it'd be interesting to hear that other people's views of that later on. Anyway, so the topic is New Atheism. What was it? In the short 20 minutes or so, 30 minutes or so that I have, it obviously is impossible to discuss all of the people involved in the so-called New Atheism. It would be impossible to address every single thing said or done by them over a period of some 6 or 7 years. So as much as time allows, I'd be making a couple of points regarding the three main characters or the three main figures of the New Atheism, and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, and briefly, I'll mention the late Christopher Hitchens. It's probably a good way of dealing with the subject, actually, because their respective books, The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation for Harris, and The God Delusion for Dawkins, and Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great, I Am. Sorry, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. It sort of provided the manifesto, if you like, for and that helped to give the appearance of a movement and what came to be called the New Atheism. As did the appearance of these people, of course, at numerous meetings and debates and conferences and so on. And they were certainly considered the main leaders of New Atheism. They also perfectly exemplify the utter shallowness of the New Atheist thinking, the fact that there was nothing underpinning New Atheism in terms of substantial ideas, the fact that it was little more than cherry-picking one or two of capitalism's problems, which in turn, of course, was nothing more than a pointless exercise in asking the wrong questions and being smugly satisfied with the easy answers. Their big thing, of course, was and still is, especially with Dawkins, I only care about what's true. It's all about the truth. I'm only interested in what's true. The important thing is the science and scientific facts and free scientific inquiry and so on. This was their mantra, especially him, and it still is. And at the end, I'll make some points actually about what we might learn from the new atheism, and hopefully there'll be a talking point or two. When discussing the atheism and its cherry picking of easy targets and its essential cowardliness and shallowness, it's sucking up to Microsoft and Apple billionaires, and it's sucking up to the rich and powerful, and it's sucking up to capitalism in general. It's posturing as martyrs for free speech, and it claims to be only interested in free scientific inquiry and so on. To tell you the truth, I'm half tempted to simply quote a passage from Karl Marx's preface to the 1867 first German edition of the first volume of Capital and leave it at that, almost say, you know, there you go, discuss. I know we are loath to treat the man's words as a holy writ or something. This from Marx really says it all for me in regard to the new atheism. It's hard to believe it was written over 150 years ago, incidentally. This is what Marx wrote, and I quote, "In the domain of political economy, a free scientific inquiry meets not merely the same enemies as in all other domains. The peculiar nature of the materials it deals with summons its foes into the field of battle, the most violent, mean, and malignant passions of the human breast, the furies of private interest. The English established church, for example, will more readily pardon an attack on 38 of its 39 articles of faith than it will an attack on 1/39th of its wealth. Nowadays, atheism is a relatively slight sin as compared with criticism of existing property relations," unquote. And, you know, in any discussion of new atheism, this should be absolutely kept in mind. It really is, it's such a profound truth and essentially sums up the cowardly shallowness of Dawkins and Harris and Leigh Hitchens perfectly. What Marx is saying, of course, is, atheism, big deal. Nobody gives a toss. Even back in 1867, nobody gave a toss. Encroachments on capital, on property, questioning the economic system. Well, even the Church of England draws the line at that. You can attack their faith all you like. They'd reintroduce burning at the stake if you laid a hand on their property rights. That's exactly the thing about New Atheists. New Atheists have never had any interest whatsoever in material reality for all their talk. Why was it called New Atheism? Certainly not as I say, on account of them having any great new ideas. That's for sure. As they admitted themselves, the only reason they were given the title New was that those who came to be seen as the three main figureheads that I mentioned, Horace, Dawkins and Hitchens, they sort of acquired a reputation, utterly unjustified in my opinion, for being sort of aggressive and strident and even militant in a way. Dawkins, of course, especially was seen in this way. But that's the only reason why they're seen as being, they got the name New Atheists, because they sort of had a new approach, so to speak. You know, they weren't like Bertrand Russell, when he spoke to you, you know, he sounded like your granda. These people were sort of in your face and this kind of thing. But that's the only reason. I suppose the opening salvo from the New Atheists came from Sam Harris in the shape of his books, The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation. This was around 2004. You'd be forgiven for saying, who's Sam Harris? And that's exactly what I said when I first heard of him as well. I'd never heard of him before. Apparently, he was still studying for his PhD in his mid-40s. Nothing wrong with that, of course. Except that, if you're seen as the person who kicks off an entire movement, and, regardless of the subject, if you're still studying for your PhD in your mid-40s, you're probably not a genius. His book became a New York Times bestseller. And as the title suggests, Harris's book revealed that although he didn't really give a toss for the thousand and won problems, harms, and miseries created by American capitalism in America. He was ever so seriously concerned about the harm that religious faith was doing thousands of miles away. The book opens with Horace sort of setting the scene for the rest of it. The young man boards a bus in Jerusalem. He has a rucksack on his back in which there's explosives, nails and bolts. The young man detonates the explosives, killing himself and 22 others on the bus. And Horace concludes, "Why is it so painfully easy to guess the religion of the young man?" And the book goes on in a similar vein. Horace actually, after that book became famous, and he became famous and made a lot of money on it, which I think was the reason why he was in it in the first place. I tend to quote Noam Chomsky a lot. I'm not that big a fan of his, but I do remember certain things. He started off by saying that the only people who aren't in it for the money, the new atheism, is Richard Dawkins. The only person, rather, is Richard Dawkins. And I would sort of agree with him, but I would add that the only reason he wasn't in it for the money was because he already had all the money. Horace morphed into a propagandist for the American government's so-called war on terror. And he was an apologist for various actions for promoting actions against Muslims, profiling Muslims at airports and so on, the idea being that if you looked like a Muslim, you were probably a terrorist, and you should be in for special treatment from the American state. Supporting waterboarding and so on, which of course was the American government torturing unarmed prisoners. And he even put forward the idea that it might actually be moral and ethical for the American government to kill someone for simply having an idea, the idea being that they don't like America very much. Anyway, he sort of sullied his reputation a good deal, but he was still sort of the mouthpiece for the new atheism, and certainly could be seen at that. Kicked the whole thing off. But Horace's entire book is one long discussion, sort of critical of faith, and it's the title, The End of Faith. And, you know, it was a plea for sanity to prevail. Curiously enough, though, Horace's sanity and plea for sanity didn't stress to himself. Horace has never shown any real concern about harm his own faith does. His faith in American capitalism, for example, one aspect of which he's especially fond and is a very outspoken advocate of Americans' gun culture. In fact, you could add to Horace's bus scenario in Jerusalem any number of equally horrific scenarios, and you could set them up in any city in America at any time, including the very city he lives in. In fact, you could set it up outside his door. Here's one that I thought of earlier on there, that I scribbled. A young black man holds up a liquor store. He's brandishing the automatic weapon he acquired for a pittance so easily and effortlessly just that morning. The liquor store owner pulls out his own gun, as he's had occasion to do numerous times in the past. The young man shoots the store owner, but not before the store owner had managed to secretly press the alarm connected to the police station. The young man grabs the trifling amount from the till as he tries to escape. Police block his way. They make a half-hearted attempt to arrest him, but almost inevitably shoot him dead instead. The young man was 14 years old. Why is it so painfully easy to guess the country that this occurred in? It does occur in about 30,000 times a year. You know, to my knowledge, religion on religion has never killed anyone in the United States. The easy availability of guns in the and the dictates and the results of American capitalism, in this case in relation to guns, it kills about 30,000 people a year. It's the cause of untold misery outside Sam Harris's door. And not only is he not an opponent of it, he's actually an advocate of it. He actually supports it. And this is just one aspect of the matter as far as Harris is concerned. It's merely illustrative of how the new atheists would cherry-pick their concerns. Again, the utter shallowness of the thinking is almost depressing. And these were people who, as Richard Dawkins never tired of telling us, were, you know, they're only interested in scientific analysis and scientific facts and so on. They're only interested in the truth. And to be it with Christian apologist William Lane Craig, Horace lamented the fact that, I'll quote this, I don't think it's verbatim actually, I'll quote it anyway, it's the gist of what he said. He said something like, by the time I finish this sentence, 15,000 children will have died from preventable diseases or hunger. This is the person who, you know, he only wants the truth and the scientific facts. This is a person also who, never having read a word of it, errorly dismisses Marx's scientific analysis of capitalism. The capitalism that demands to make profits in the production and distribution of food and medicines before it will give them to these dying children. Marx isn't the slightest bit of interest because, according to him, and this is a verbatim quote about Marx, no one thinks that is science anymore, unquote. He's never read a word of it, as I say. He just knows that it isn't science. He's not interested in it, of course, because it's too difficult a subject, only criticizing religion. Richard Dawkins, of course, was and is exactly the same. He brought out the God Delusion in 2006, sort of, again, a manifesto for the new atheists. And again, it probably gave the biggest boost to the new atheism. As I said, it was published in 2006, big bestseller, big blockbuster. Dawkins, of course, was on every TV program, interviews and chat shows and documentaries. Here he is in a show in Sweden, and then he's on a show in Germany and all over America, and here he is in the Late Late Show in Ireland and so on and so forth. He was never off the TV at the time. And of course, there's so much that can be said about Dawkins, of course. He's written so much and is so well known. To keep it short, Dawkins, of course, is a vociferous opponent of the harm caused by religion. He's got absolutely no interest whatsoever in the harm done by capitalism. As far outweighs any supposed religious harm. There's no better illustration of this utter shallowness of Richard Dawkins than the opening few pages of God Delusion. Imagine, along with John Lennon, he implores. And actually, he's imploring the wrong person, because I'm one of the few people who doesn't think that the Beatles are down in the wrong order. I'm one of the people who used to think that, you know, I wish that Vietnamese Buddhist monk had spent a week in bed with Yoko Ono and grown his hair for peace, and John Lennon had to set himself on fire instead. I couldn't stand that bloke. He was such a fraud as well. But imagine... Dawkins says, imagine with John Lennon, imagine no religion. Then he gives us a list of things that religion is supposedly responsible for, half of which, of course, had nothing whatsoever to do with religion or merely had a tenuous link to religion. I must say, I was astonished to learn that the troubles in Northern Ireland were caused by religion. I've lived in Northern Ireland all my life, and I was pretty sure there was something to do with a border and the partition of the country and so on. And you know, 800 years of struggle to get back to Gerry Adams. So I was astonished to hear that. But and this is the kind of thing that Dawkins does all the time. You know, he throws out this little snippet and he can never back any of it up with any facts. In fact, one of the worst Irish nationalist groups, the INLA, it was a little Leninist sect. And it was the most vicious group of them all. You know, the biggest advocate of getting the British out by killing them, the British soldiers and so on and so forth. And as I said, the INLA, in the Irish National Liberation Army, as opposed to the National Liberation Army of Ireland, or the Irish Liberation Palestinian, or the Irish, we'll say Palestinian there, the Irish People's Liberation Organization, as opposed to the People's Liberation Organization of Ireland. You know, people may know about that Monty Python sketch in The Life of Brian. They must have surely got that from from Northern Ireland. Anyway, so the INLA used to have a leader who was a Protestant. Not only was he a Protestant, but he was the son of a friend of Ian Paisley, and was there, in fact, when the DUP, the so-called Democratic Unionist Party, was actually established. In fact, it was Protestants that murdered him because he was the leader of the INLA. And there's been numerous Catholics who supported the link with Britain. In fact, I would say the majority of Catholics in Northern Ireland now would probably support the link with Britain, as indeed would the majority of people in the south of Ireland there. Have no interest whatsoever. The majority of people in the south being Catholics have no interest whatsoever in uniting Ireland. So Dobbin's view, you know, that it's all based on religion, it's complete and utter nonsense. But Dawkins, of course, isn't interested in anything but the religious angle. I mean, that song, Imagine, you know, as Dawkins says, you know, imagine no religion, he takes it from that song. But that song actually has a hell of a lot more to it, of course, than no religion. The no religion is only a tiny part of it. And indeed, in relation to that song, John Lennon always denied that it had anything to do with religion or hating religion. He always says that I'm certainly against, you know, my God's bigger than your God type of religion. But he always called it and said it was a song, an anti-capitalistic song and so on. Imagine there's no countries. Does Dawkins ever think about that? You know, we've states and so on, and state borders and so on. And nothing to kill or die for. Imagine no possessions. Again, has Dawkins ever given that 5 minutes thought? When he's listened to that song or read the lyrics? No need for greed or hunger, brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. Dawkins, of course, has never given that 5 seconds thought. Lennon's song was a damn sight more to say than just imagine no religion. And Richard Dawkins is perfectly well aware of it, of course. He's also incidentally well aware of the SPGB and our policy of barring people from joining if they are religious, our advocacy of materialism and our outspoken defence of Darwin. He's well aware of it because he's been told often enough. When he brought it to God delusion, he also started a website, which I must admit was quite good actually back in the day. I managed to get about 700 comments or more posted on there, many of which were about the party and supporting socialism and so on. And we also had an article, in fact, from the Socialist Standard, written by our own Paddy Shannon on Darwin, published on there too. You know, Dawkins is only interested in the scientific analysis and the scientific facts, and only interested in the truth and so on. He must be, like, because he tells us often enough. But again, here's an example of Dawkins' regard for the truth. Steven Pinker is a fellow traveller of the New Atheism. Dawkins refers to him all the time as my colleague. He's a professor of something or other, and he writes books. Boy, does he write books. He writes a 1,000-page book about every 6 months, most of which, incidentally, is of very dubious ferocity. But one of his books tells the story of when the police went on strike in Montreal a few years ago. To cut the long story short, Pinker at the time apparently was enamoured of the Russian anarchist Michael Bakunin. I'm not entirely sure which bits of Bakunin Pinker was a big was enamoured of, because Pinker is actually a big mouthpiece these days against cancel culture, in quotation marks. He's a big martyr for freedom to offend and so on. And the thing about Michael Bakunin is when he tried to emulate the Paris Commune in another town in France, I think it was Lyon, he stood on the steps in the town hall and declared that in this democratic commune, anyone disagreeing with him would be shot. So I'm not entirely sure what part of Bakunin Pinker was enamored of, but we'll let that pass. So anyway, poor Pinker. He ended up completely deflated and depressed after this police strike. He fully expected that when the police started their one-day strike, the people of Montreal, having spent their entire existence, their entire lives, being brainwashed with money the importance of money, the need to get money. You have to get the hold of money by fair means or foul, and so on. Being brought up their entire lives exposed to violence and crime and murder and mayhem and physical abuse and mental cruelty and social strife and alienation and so on to one degree or another. Regardless of all that, when the police went on strike, Tinker fully expected the first thing that the good people of Montreal would do would be to initiate a loving in a city-wide anarchist commune in accordance with the precepts of a long-dead Russian. A long-dead Russian that no one except Pinker had ever heard of. Of course, instead, and I mean, who could have possibly predicted it? Instead, what the people of Montreal actually did was they used the opportunity of a policeless capitalism, even when they were well aware, of course, that would be short-lived, to indulge in petty theft and robbery, committing arson against their competitors and small businesses, and robbing six banks. And indeed, it has to be said, the only crimes committed, in fact, were crimes against property. And you know, you think that this was a fact, that this fact alone would, you know, tell a new atheist something. You think that there must be some scientific facts of some sort in there, some truths to learn from this episode. But no, not a bit of it, nothing. The response of Richard Dawkins was simply to express his disappointment that everyone wasn't as honest as the millionaire Richard Dawkins and the brilliant Steven Pinker stopped being an anarchist. The shallowness of thinking is absolutely deplorable. And again, this is just an example of the kind of brilliant scientific thinking of the self-proclaimed big brain boxes of the new atheism. Now, you may ask, well, so what? What's this got to do with new atheism and so on? Well, more than you think. If I was asked at any time, is there any worthwhile ideas that the new atheists came out with? I'd say yes. The ones they stole from us. Keep in mind that Pinker and Dawkins, and there's another guy called Jerry Coyne, actually. Funny enough, he just mentioned this. Pinker business was police strike only yesterday on his blog. Actually, I shouldn't call it a blog because he bars you from commenting if you don't call it a website. He's a big fan of democracy, you know. But keep in mind that these people were astonished and disappointed at the reactions of the people of Montreal. They believed that the people simply should have ignored their entire life's experience in the capitalist economic system and just show themselves to be, you know, good and honest citizens, just like the millionaire Richard Dawkins would have done. But these are the people, too, who, you know, are constantly lauding the fact that in countries where the bourgeois democratic state takes the form of a welfare state, where the money's taken off the capitalists, of course, in the form of taxes, where there's a decent social services, a reasonably full employment, and capitalism isn't in a slump, unemployment benefit, childcare, an enlightened judicial and prison regime, as much as you can have that, of course, democratic freedoms and so on. Much to the new atheist delight, these are the very countries in which not only is there less crime and so on, but where atheism is the strongest and religion is the weakest. Everyone has heard of the quote from Marx that religion is the opium of the people, and the new atheists love that. It's the one concession to Marx, in fact, that they never make. Or I should say they love the start of it, at least. The quote is, religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. It is the heart of a heartless world, just as it is the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. Look at those societies that aren't heartless and soulless, the new atheists will tell you. They're the ones where religion disappears, where religion is non-existent practically. In Montreal, it's bad that people act in response to their life's experiences and their material conditions. But in somewhere like Sweden, it's great that people react to their life's experiences and their material conditions. These are positive because, of course, it encourages atheism. In other words, they agree with us that the best chance of getting rid of religion is to establish socialism. But they've absolutely no interest in reality. For all their talk about, you know, we're only interested in what's true, it's never been true. They don't, of course, care much for the second part of that quote of Marx. And in fact, they do the same to Marx what they always whine about the creationists do to Darwin. They cherry pick the bits of a quote that suits them. Marx, of course, goes on to say that the criticism of religion is the illusory happiness of people. Is at the same time a criticism of the conditions that require illusions. And he goes on to say there's a demand for their real happiness, a demand to change reality. And of course, new atheists like Dawkins and they've got absolutely no interest whatsoever or intentions of even trying to change the conditions that requires illusions. Economics and politics and class struggle. This is the reality. But the thing is, you know, it isn't scientific, you see. I see I've taken up quite a bit of time there, actually. I'll just go very quickly. I'll say just very briefly about Hitchens, since he was the third one. Hitchens, too, of course, we were assured was only interested in a scientific analysis and scientific facts and only interested in the truth and so on. You know, to be honest, the less said about that ex-Trotskyist Popinjay, as George Galloway famously called him, the less said about him, the better. But I'll just mention one piece of nonsense just to give you a quick flavour of that new atheist genius and intellectual that they held in such a high regard. As Trotskyist, I think he was a member of the IAS, the International Socialist, was it? I think it's the forerunner of the SWP, I'm not quite sure. But as a Trotskyist, I think he was in it for about 30 years, actually, although I don't think Hitchens could get everyone remember. And so for 30 years, Hitchens would have supported any party or anybody or any program or any regime, monstrous or otherwise. He supported, of course, the regime in Iraq in the early 1990s, and then had a completely different opinion when George Bush called him in to investigate what his views were on invasion in Iraq in the second Gulf War. The invasion of Iraq generally. Anyway, so for 30 years he would have supported anything, as I say, monstrous or other ways that decked itself in a red flag. Needless to say, he was previously extremely enamoured of the Bolshevik coup. In his pre-New Atheist life, the Leninist coup was to him a full-scale, genuine, all-in socialist revolution with all of the historical and social and economic and personal ramifications and so on that this would involve. And, of course, led by his lifelong hero, Leon Trotsky. Hold on a minute. Now that he was living in this new atheist world order, this new world order of the atheists, wasn't Joseph Stalin, didn't he attend a religious seminary at the age of 16? And didn't he learn there how to be a dictator? The implication, of course, being from Hitchens that a 16-year-old born attending a seminary in Georgia equals the entire collapse of the socialist society. Complete and utter nonsense. I heard Hitchens spout this rubbish numerous times when challenged with the assertion that the atheism he was preaching was the atheism of the so-called communists in Russia, and it led to the horrors of mass slaughter. But Hitchens' reply, absolutely no scientific analysis whatsoever, no interest in the facts whatsoever, just sheer and utter shallowness of thought. The complete disconnect from reality was quite frightening with him, actually. And, of course, he was seen as one of their big intellectuals. Anyway, the last thing I'll mention is, you know, I think you should bear in mind that just because someone has slapped a label onto some loosely defined group or or calls itself a movement. That doesn't, of course, mean that there's any real coherent case of any substance behind it. And probably it's just old ideas decked out in a new suit, a new tuxedo. And anyone who falls a subject like religion, which is seemingly divorced from such profane matters as economics and putting food on the table and so on, it's usually just some lame attempt at wrestling with the material problems inherent in capitalism. It's essentially just about trying to deal with the effects of capitalism. It's simply reforms. And of course, as we know, when it comes to reforms of capitalism, as it says in a good book, if you excuse the phrase, there truly is nothing new under the sun. And this is especially the case with the so-called new atheism. There wasn't anything new about it. There were no new ideas, no new ways of looking at things, and no serious analysis of the world and its problems. And despite all the self-proclaimed and so-called clear thinking and the search for the truth, despite all the thousands of meetings, the conferences, the debates, the numerous groups and so on that sprang up in various countries, the joint statements and the organizations across continents and so on, the books and the articles and so on, there was not really valid analysis of the material causes of the object of their hatred. The object of their hatred, of course, being religion. Well, they showed any sense at all. It's only when they stole those ideas from socialists, from the Marxists. Okay, very quickly, where did it all go? Hitchens used to say that if it was a good thing, that if he told you he was an atheist, you couldn't tell anything else about him. You could, actually, in his case. But anyway, you know, he could be an atheist nihilist or an atheist communist or an atheist flat earthist or an atheist serial killer. And, of course, therein lay the problem. Apparently, all the massive brain power at their disposal notwithstanding, they were as innocent as lambs. The Christian religion has been torn asunder over centuries into 30,000 denominations. If you take Richard Dawkins seriously, and you believe that the atheists were all big brain boxes and people who were all absolutely clear thinking and serious people not to be trifled with and so on, and all extremely decent and hardworking and honest people and so on, you'd have to believe that the new atheists were going to stick together come hell or high water. Based on nothing more, it has to be said, than their agreement that there's probably no invisible man living in the sky. But the belief that there's no invisible man living in the sky was hardly the super glue that was going to keep this mob together. And needless to say, the inevitable happened. Basically, they split up into two factions. One faction, in fact, were a bit admirable from our point of view. They wanted it to be just a bit more than, you know, the big scarlet A. You know, you ever see Richard Dawkins? He has this big red A on his lapel, you know. Sometimes he wears one that says, I am six. They wanted it to be more atheism plus what they would call social justice. Reformism, in other words, atheism plus feminism, atheism plus anti-poverty, atheism plus anti-right-wing politics in America, atheism plus anti-Republican party politics and so on. And the other faction were those who saw the whole thing as a money-making scam or people who already had money and they saw it more as a hobby, you know, the whole Dawkins creed. To give you very quickly, there's two people there that are a good comparison. There's a guy called P.C. Myers and another one called Michael Shermer. Myers is a developmental biologist and a professor at the university in Minnesota. He runs a blog called Pharyngula. We, of course, don't give much credence to the left-right spectrum in politics, of course, but I'll use it for convenience. Myers is a big-time left-winger. I mean, there's nothing that could be described as left that he doesn't admire. For him, it really is the socialist fire department and the socialist highway maintenance crew. He wants a socialist national health service and a socialist minimum wage, and he wants to tax the rich. not only till the pipsqueak. He wants the tax of rich out of existence, if possible. He's a big supporter of women's rights and LGBT and pulling down statues of racists, rewriting American history to tell the truth. You name anything that gets dismissed as extreme left or woke, as they say these days, and Marsh supports it. He's also an extremely nice man, into the bargain, very intelligent man too. On the other hand, there's Michael Shermer. He's a loathsome, odious, right-wing ideologue. The sort of person who thinks that Ayn Rand was a philanthropist. He's a right-wing shyster and a spiv. I used to call him the Arthur Daly of New Atheism. He's a kind of right ideologist. He's certainly educated in a certain sense. He's a right-wing ideologist who would quote the Austrian School of Economics and Friedrich Hayek and von Mises and so on and tell you why Marxism and socialism can't work because of the lack of a price mechanism to tell you what to produce, all this kind of stuff. He's in it in a big way. But he's used that new atheism basically to make money. He never had money in the past. He used to bring out a magazine called The Skeptic. He never made any money on it. But then the new atheism comes along. I heard that guy tell people that he wasn't an atheist before that whole thing started. So that's why I know he's a shyster. But he's also the kind of person, and I'll say this out loud because it's public knowledge. It's already been published on the internet, and he's never taken it to court or anything. His big thing was to use the meetings. And incidentally, he's still a great friend of Richard Dawkins. You know, Richard Dawkins opposes the Catholic Church and so on, and thinks the Catholic Church is the biggest criminal organization in the world and so on. Well, he's the person that goes to these meetings. He speaks at not so much now since they broke up, but he went to the meetings and he spoke on the platform and debates and so on. Thought it was brilliant and got paid for it and so on. But what he used to do at the meetings, of course, was he used to pick up young girls and take them back to the hotel and get them drunk and rape them. That's who Michael Shermer is. And as I say, it's public knowledge. So as I say, the chances of this ragbag of staying together was, of course, non-existent. Leonard Dawkins' influence notwithstanding, the inevitable happened. It all blew up. But at least it went out with a bang and not a whimper. It all happened in Ireland, in fact. It was called Elevator Gate. And I can tell you about that. I know I have to finish here. I can tell you about that some other time. But let me very quickly finish by saying a couple of things about anything we can learn. It's both interesting and important, I think, for us to understand a phenomenon like the new atheism, because I think it has a number of similarities to our own efforts. I think that it wouldn't take much for our own views to catch on and spread as quickly as the new atheism did. And the new atheist managed to combine a sort of a single offend, the attack on the World Trade Center at that time, and with some seemingly relevant ratings. And they managed to catch the attention of opinion formers and TV producers and book publishers and so on. And all at the same time as well. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't do the same thing if the opportunity arose. And maybe we should try and create the opportunity, of course. I think we learned that a largely positive democratic organization, sort of non-hierarchical and so on, can get established pretty quickly and practically worldwide. I think we learned also that great individual personalities do more harm than good. We should cherish the fact that we don't have leaders and so on, and we don't have people to look up to, because the people like Richard Dawkins absolutely destroyed that whole what you can once call a movement. So individual personalities, I think we've learned that they're absolutely the worst thing to rely on. I think we learned as well that an interested and knowledgeable and motivated general membership, with that, great things can be achieved, and many small and many local activities and so on. And I think we learned that, and this is the very last point I'll make, I'm sorry for taking up so much time, I think we learned also that the most important lesson of all, that a common objective is absolutely essential, and a common set of principles is utterly indispensable, because without those, ultimately, everything always blows up, just like it did with the new atheists. Thank you very much. That's me.